morning. I am Yada, and this is Shattering Myths. It's a program which is committed to exposing the beguiling and destructive nature of the myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, my mission will be to help you appreciate what is actually occurring behind the headlines, to expose the motivations of the perpetrators, and to share what you can do to protect your family, all while predicting how these events will ultimately shape America and the world's future over the next 20 years. Then, during our second hour, we will engage Yahweh on his terms by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable and relevant Torah teaching, so that God's guidance can be used to replace religion with reason. Our phone number for those who would like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said on this program is 877-300-7645. And for those just looking for answers, if you want to know and have access to the research which led to the insights and conclusions presented on Shattering Myths, I would encourage you to go to introtogod.org. We turn to the news and we find that the truce that was brokered by Egypt's new Islamist leader working with the United States is alleged to have headed off an Israeli invasion of Gaza. Personally, I do not think that is accurate. I do not think that Egypt played a role in brokering a truce, and I don't think that Israel was going to invade Gaza. I think Israel recognized that what they were doing was having its designed effect. And that all that really happened here is that Egypt, which is in a horrible economic slump, depression, if you will, ever since electing the Islamist Muslim Brotherhood leader, Mohammed Morsi, was threatened by the United States that we would curtail our financial generosity if Egypt didn't shut the rockets down in Gaza. And knowing that he wanted the rockets to continue to be fired, and knowing that he had no control over Hamas, and knowing the United States couldn't negotiate with Hamas because Hamas is a terrorist organization, Morsi said, hey, we can spin this as if it were a Hamas win and you can be celebrated around the world. We can say that you bloodied Israel's nose and therefore you cowered Israel and therefore we won. And that is precisely what happened. And then bathing in that victory, look at the aftermath. Mohammed Morsi becomes a dictator, exactly as we predicted would happen with the so-called Arab Spring, because it's not an Arab Spring, it's an Islamic Reformation. Morsi's role, it says in one article, in cajoling his Islamist soulmates and Gaza into the U.S.-backed deal with Israel suggested that Washington can find ways to cooperate with the Muslim Brotherhood leader whom Egyptians elected after toppling former U.S. ally Hosni Mubarak, a bulwark of American policy in the Middle East for 30 years. Yeah, it worked great. When you ally with evil, to combat evil, you become evil and you promote evil. Such was the stupid approach, the immoral approach that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had in World War II, where he allied with Mao Zedong and with Stalin, and as a result, not only left Europe and Asia worse than we found them, and thus lost a war that we claimed to have won, but we incorporated their ideals into our culture. When the United States decided that it would pal up with the Muslim Brotherhood to influence Hamas, what we unleashed was a terrible tragedy. Mohammed Morsi is now Egypt's new pharaoh. the sole dictator in a land that has never known free will or choice, at least has not known it in a very long time. Mercy, preoccupied with Egypt's economic crisis, this article reads, cannot afford to tamper with the 1979 peace treaty with Israel, despite his popularity with Egyptians, and needs, because he needs, U.S. financial aid. The reality is that had Mohammed Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood had their way, they would have invaded Israel as opposed to have precluded Egypt from, or Israel from invading Gaza. Their goal, their hope, is to have Egypt ally with Hamas and invade Israel. This is a quote, the battle with the enemy has not ended yet. The leader of Hamas's armed wing, the Izz el-Din al-Qassam Brigades, said at an event to mourn its acting military chief, Ahmad al-Jabari, who was killed by Israel on November 14th, which according to this article set off this round. That is factually untrue. What set off this round was the increasing number of rockets that were being launched into Israel as a direct result of Egypt no longer policing the Sinai and of Libya no longer under the dictatorship of Muammar Gaddafi, but instead under the control of Mujahideen, of fundamentalist Islamic jihadists who are armed to the teeth. The combination of these things is what allowed the increased flow of armaments into Hamas, and the U.S. invasion of Iraq, which gave Iraq to Iran, enabled Iran to sponsor the production of rockets in Gaza. Collectively, these things are the very things that led to this round where Israel responded, cause and effect, by assassinating the man most to blame for the increase arsenal of rockets being launched into civilian areas within Israel. President Morsi was praised by the United States for his personal contribution for contributing to the de-escalation of hostilities between Gaza and Israel, when in fact what he contributed most to was the de-escalation of democracy in Egypt. Islam means submission, after all. This article then followed the previous one. President Mohammed Morsi has appeared before supporters in Cairo to defend his new decree that grants him total dictatorial powers. He told those listening that Egypt is on the path to freedom and democracy and that he was a guardian of those goals. So the very man who said, I am now dictator, says that, oh, but read my lips. I am a patriot. I am leading Egypt toward freedom and democracy, when his Muslim Brotherhood knows neither and is opposed to both, as is he, and he just announced himself sole dictator of Egypt. Hypocrisy always reigns when it comes to those who are both religious and political. Quote, I am the guarantor of that. And I will protect for my brothers all opposition to their rights so that they can exercise their role. So the very man that called himself infallible, the one whose words and decrees cannot be overturned by anyone, the one who is as God in Egypt, said that I am the guarantor of freedom and democracy. Mr. Morsi also vowed to defend the independence of the executive and judiciary legislature branches and was not issuing decrees to settle old scores. Again, pure hypocrisy. He said that the judiciary was no longer independent, but fell under his control, and that their decisions were not binding on anyone. And, of course, there is no legislature in Egypt. It was disbanded. Mr. El Baradei, a Nobel Prize, Peace Prize winner, wrote that the president had appointed himself as Egypt's new pharaoh. It was a major blow to the revolution that could have dire consequences. It wasn't a blow to the revolution, Mr. El Baradi. You may be a Nobel Peace Prize winner, but you've lost the ability to think. It was a consequence of the Islamic Reformation that swept through Egypt and through much of the Islamic world. A direct consequence of what happened. It was not a blow to the revolution because the revolution had nothing to do with democracy and everything to do with Islam. Buoyed by accolades from around the world for mediating a truce between Hamas and Israel, Mercy on Thursday ordered that an Islamist-dominated assembly writing a new constitution could not, in fact, be dissolved by legal challenges. He has become a temporary dictator, was the headline of the independent newspapers in Egypt. Mercy, the article reads, is an Islamist whose roots are in the Muslim Brotherhood. And as a result, he gave himself sweeping powers that allowed him to sack the unpopular general prosecutor, and he opened the door for retrial of Mubarak and all of his aides. It's about settling scores. The president's decree said any decrees he issued, while no parliament sat, could not be challenged. Moves that consolidate his power, threatening ever more turbulence in Egypt, at the nation at the very heart of what is called the Arab Spring. Welcome to the new dictator. Welcome to Islam. The turmoil has weighed heavily on Egypt's failing and faltering economy that was thrown a lifeline this week when a preliminary deal was struck with the International Monetary Fund for an additional $4.8 billion in loans, all that in addition to the many billions supplied each year by the United States. Thousands of the president's supporters, however, gathered near the presidential palace. They were not chanting for Mohamed Morsi to cease his dictatorial rule. No, they were chanting, the people want the implementation of Sharia. They chanted as Morsi addressed them at a rally called by the Muslim Brotherhood, we want the Sharia of Allah. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll be back in a moment, turning our attention to Syria.
Good day.
Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yana. For those who would like to join in this discussion, our number is 877-300-7645. You know, it was interesting to me during this whole uprising in Gaza, where the Hamas-controlled Gaza Strip decided that it would be in their interest to start launching an ever-increasing supply of rockets into Israel to force Israel into responding and then putting their children in harm's way, which led inexorably to the death of their children and to sorrowful images that were plastered over newspapers around the world, causing sympathy for this despicable religion of Islam and of the myth known as the Palestinian people, that during this time, not too very far away, in fact, almost adjacent to this, 40,000 people were dying. Now, in this conflict, it was 100 or so who died. The newspapers will tell you that 50% of whom were civilians. Of course, there is no distinction between a military and civilian casualties in a nation without a military. But nonetheless, it was in the 100 or so numbers-wise. And yet, when we turn to Syria, it's 40,000. Now, why doesn't the world seem to care in Syria? Is it just because it's Muslims killing Muslims, not Jews and Muslims at war with each other? Well, in Syria, the death toll has now exceeded 40,000. And it's all occurred in 20 months of conflict between Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's Shiite forces and those fighting for his overthrow, almost all of whom are fundamentalist Sunni Muslims, many of whom were armed by America and Iraq, many of whom are armed by Saudi Arabia and Qatar to fight a proxy war against Shia Islam. It is a war that is being also fought on behalf of another set of proxies. The United States and Europe on one side with China and Russia on the other. And yet, this was the war that was ignored for the past 2 weeks. The head of the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that about half the fatalities there were civilians and the other half split about evenly between rebels and government soldiers. Well, at least this person is trying to make a distinction between civilians on behalf of the Sunnis engaged in the uprising, the Mujahideen, and those who are simply supporting the Mujahideen. The figure is likely to rise even higher, much higher, as the rebels and the government. Why don't we just say this like it is? While the Sunni fundamentalist Mujahideen and the government Shiite forces, and in this particular case, both lie about how many of their forces have died to make it appear like they're winning. In other words, they're both understating casualties. Further, deceased people in this war of 40,000 thus far does not include the 15 to 20,000, some say as many as 80,000, who are simply missing, who no one knows where they are, whether they were kidnapped by the Sunni Mujahideen or kidnapped by the Shiite forces loyal to Iran. No one knows. The death toll could well be 80,000. And yet the entire world seemed focused, mesmerized by the death of hundreds. CNN, Lazio is a soccer team in Italy. They were involved in a home game. It was a draw, 0-0, against Tottenham Hotspur in a top European club football match. Now, why would I bring this up in the news? Because it was marred by anti-Semitic chanting. The chant, spur Jews, came from the stands. A banner also appeared that said, free Palestine, during the midst of the chants. Now, I tell you this story for two reasons. One is the rise of anti-Semitism, and second, the role that Romans, now Italians, played in the creation of the myth that is Palestine. There is no place on earth known as Palestine. There are no people called Palestinians. All of that is a myth that was promoted by the very people whose vile regime attacked and destroyed Israel, crucifying hundreds of thousands while destroying its temple. We'll return to this story in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mist. If you'd like to engage in this discussion, you are welcome to call 877-300-7645. As I was dealing with this story on the not only the myth that there is such thing as a Palestinian people, but that there is such a place in Palestine, Scott directed me to a site that happens to be on Wiki that includes many of the quotes of one Golda Meir, this one in particular. There were no such thing as Palestinians. When was there an independent Palestinian people or a Palestinian state? You know, we're talking about this because of the chant of the mindless and immoral Roman Catholics in Italy who were shouting dispersions to Jews and holding slogans and banners saying, free Palestine. There is no such thing as Palestine. There has never been a Palestinian people. There is no such thing as a place. This is a myth that was created in right around 133 to 135 CE. Judea, which was a Roman province, one captured by the Romans when they took over that which had been captured by the Greeks, when the Greeks captured that which had been an independent state, that the Romans were to achieve what they call peace was to destroy anyone and anything that threatened their legitimacy. And so here was one of the most savage and immoral pagan regimes of all human history, and if you spoke up against them, if you rose up against them, they sought your utter destruction and to have your destruction serve as a witness to the world. So they took the province of Judea, and they decided, we're going to rename the place. We're going to dust off the old moniker of the Philistines who lived in Gaza many, many, many centuries ago. Some, 700, 800 years ago, when the Assyrians came and annihilated them. Every Philistine was killed. There are no surviving Philistines. There are no Palestinians. You see, the Romans decided, we'll rename this land Philistia, Philistine, as the old moniker of the so-called Philistines that had been annihilated so many centuries ago. It is a myth. But those indoctrinated by religion promote myths, particularly when those myths slur Yahweh's chosen people. We are going to cover an email that was sent to me in a future program, one where I was not bemoaning the death of Muslim children in Gaza. And if you sympathize with the death of Muslim children in Gaza, then they have prevailed over you. That was their goal. They attacked Israel for the express purpose of forcing Israel to respond, and they put their children not in harm's way. They ordered their parents to keep their children right beside where they launched the rockets, knowing that Israel's only response had to be to bomb those sites and therefore the collateral damage being their children. So if you sympathized with the death of their children, then you allowed them to prevail. That was their intent. This is a statement that Golda Meir made back in Agony of the Promised Land in 2004, but it's a quote that Golda Meir had previously made. She said, peace will come when the Arabs start to love their children more than they hate us. Let me rephrase that. Peace will come when the Muslims start to love their children more than they hate Jews. Or in the case of Roman Catholic Italy, peace will come when Christians start to love their own children more than they hate Yahweh's chosen people, Yah's testimony through them. There are a number of quotes here that will make good additions to the program that we devote to why it is appropriate not to be concerned about the collateral damage that was done in Gaza that was specifically designed to evoke an emotional response, thinking that, oh, those Jews are bad because they're baby killers. We'll devote an entire program to that on a future day. Moving one more. There's a nature of religion, I guess, and the politics blended together. Socialist secular humanism, communism is a religion. It's a religion which elevates man to the status of God. There's a propaganda slogan, now extolling the virtues of North Korea's new leader that has been erected on a hillside in North Korea. This is a sign that can only be seen from an airplane, which means that none of North Korea's citizens can see it, or from a satellite's or from the heavens. The message, which stretches for more than 1,800 feet and has characters that are 65 feet tall individually, reads, "Long live General Kim Jong-un, the shining sun!" Exclamation point. Not shining sun, S-O-N, shining sun, S-U-N. It reminds me specifically of the introduction to the King James Bible, where King Ions is called the shining sun. Gives you a clear indication of what religion does to men. We're going to return now to the ongoing series I was doing on the economy, and hopefully between today's program and tomorrow's, we'll be able to conclude this review. We have already reviewed how we originally got into this mix, how we turned to back to 1913, and we see the creation of the Internal Revenue Service and progressive taxation via an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and we see the creation of the Federal Reserve in stealth to make it appear as if it's anything but a central bank, and we noticed how the combination of those things led America immediately to a war that was fought entirely to save a banker, J.P. Morgan, that cost Americans their lives when they had nothing to gain, no interest in that war whatsoever, and then to a Great Depression in the early, late 19-teens, early 1920s period, and then whose policies exacerbated the next recession, which was called the Great Depression under FDR, and how he turned what would have lasted a year and a half into well over a decade, all because of his war against the very machines that drive the economy. This then took us to the period where we ended, and rather than continuing to go backwards in time, or forward in time, I want to go backwards in time. I'd like to begin where we are now. At the end of Barack Obama's first 4 years, the U.S. government federal budget spending is now $3.8 trillion. If you go back to when he took office, it was $3.52 trillion. If you go back to Bush, who preceded him, and you look at the last 12 years, the federal budget has doubled in 12 years. We have a spending problem. It has gone from $1.86 trillion in 2001, Bush's first year, to $3.8 trillion in the current year under Obama. It has more than doubled. So spending increased 204%, more than doubling, or in real numbers, it increased $1,940 billion. At the same time, revenues were up 24% for the 12 years ending 2012. During that period, there were 7 years with Republicans in control of Congress and 4 with Democrats in control of Congress. 8 of the 12 years, there was a Republican president. So the spending problem, which nearly tripled the national debt, increasing it from less than $5.7 trillion to more than $16.2 trillion over the most recent 12 years, has to be blamed mostly, by a margin of two-thirds, on Republicans. So for those of you who vote Republican to think that you are serving your children's interests and your country's interest by limiting government spending, think again. This most recent deficit, this surge in government spending and the deficit, was sponsored by Republicans this time, not Democrats, which tells you there is no longer a positive distinction between them. And there had been a history where it was irrefutable. If Republicans were in charge of Congress, taxes went down and the economy soared. There was no deficit, there were surpluses. But now, it is a mess. And it does not, to some degree, it does not matter who's occupies the most seats of Congress. That's the best that can be said. At worst, the problem now falls almost squarely on the Republicans for having created the mess that we endure today. The Bush-era Republicans turned a $128 billion surplus into a $1.4 trillion deficit. Nicely done, boys. The Bush tax cuts have been blamed for unfairly benefiting the rich while depriving the poor and for increasing the deficit. But neither position is historically accurate. The primary beneficiaries of the Bush tax cuts were lower middle-class families, tens of millions of which were completely removed from the tax rolls and now pay nothing. And now the median income individual who earns $55,000 pays only 5% of that income in federal tax. Moreover, by lowering the rate on the highest wage earners, the U.S. actually increased federal revenue by $700 billion, a 28% increase in 9 years, with fewer taxpayers. And most telling, after a 13% decrease on the highest income individuals and during the midst of a recession. If you want to lower the deficit, you reduce taxes. That is one thing that remains unchanged. We're going to continue and particularly focus on the fiscal cliff and why it is a good thing, not a bad thing, when we return to Shattering Myths in a moment. To Shattering Myths. I was saying something that might have come across as a surprise where I had said that I thought that the fiscal cliff would actually be a good thing rather than a bad thing. I said so because the Bush-era tax cuts removed so many individuals from paying any tax, and they took the effective rate on median income families down to 5%, so that the tax burden is of no consequence. And so a lot of what we saw in this last election, where people voted for the tax and spend candidate, is a direct result of the Bush tax cuts. You get more people paying tax, and paying tax at a more reasonable level. 5% is not reasonable. I mean, I am for lower taxes, but 5% is too low. When you restore that, you're going to have more people paying attention, more people who personally will have something at stake. And so it's a good thing that more people will be added to the tax rolls. It's a good thing that the median income families across America will have to pay more than 5%. And it's also a good thing that government spending will be cut. And while it's only being cut a tiny percentage in the range of 2%, if we do not cut the federal government and all aspects of the federal government, including the big expenditures, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, as well as defense, by 50%, our deficit will continue to grow. And so it is actually a good thing. Now, as it turns out, the 2008 recession had nothing to do with the economy or with business, even corporations or exports. And it had everything to do with federal manipulation of mortgages. And so it is only in the from the perspective of the 1929 depression that we understand the 2008 recession and how the Federal Reserve and Congress collude to encourage people to borrow more money than they should at unsustainably low rates, so that they either buy businesses, as they did in 1929, or they buy homes, as they did in 2008, only to pull the rug out from underneath them by making credit much tougher to get and by increasing the rates and constraining the money supply. Now, if we turn to the 12 years preceding this. In fact, let's just take a smaller subset. Let's look just at the Clinton years, since the Clinton years are being presented on television, particularly during the last campaign, as the glory years. Here's the story. Spending increased $380 billion during the 8 years that Clinton was in office, or 21%. All under a Democratic president, five of which the Republicans controlled Congress. The last five. Revenues increased $110 billion, or 9%, after a 23% tax increase, a rare exemption in U.S. history. But be careful with this. The reason that tax revenues increased in the year of a tax increase is only because of the comparison between fiscal and calendar years. Individuals pay tax on a calendar year basis. The government runs its books on a fiscal year basis that closes, I believe, in September. So when it became obvious, as it is this time, that the tax rates are being increased on both capital gains and on ordinary income, what happens is that a disproportionate number of people sell whatever assets they have so that they're taxed at the lower rate. And because the calendar year ends December 31 for tax purposes, but the fiscal year we're already in, the year which taxes are raised, you get an increase in revenue only because of the sponsored selling of assets at the close of the calendar year. And that's what happened in the Clinton era. Now, with the tax rate hovering at between 39 and 40%, revenues increased $770 billion over the next 7 years, which was primarily a legacy of the Reagan economic expansion. It should be noted that deficits of $203 to $255 billion were turned into surpluses of $69 to $236 billion. And that took place as Republicans replaced Democrats in Congress. And I've shared this with you many times. The surpluses that were born out of the Clinton years were directly attributable at the time to the contract with America, where Republicans in Congress actually signed a pledge to do a certain number of things and then published their pledge. That is how not only the economy recovered, but also taxation decreased and revenues increased. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths.
I had tried everything. I'd cut back the amount of food I was eating. I was lifting weights and jogging, but nothing was working. My body was literally starving for minerals and trace.